We are now continuing this wonderful series with Jack Opperley on the history of the Black Church in America. Jack has been a good friend of the seminars for some time, and we are so grateful to have him back to talk about this, about the church, this church that has emerged from its beginnings in slavery into a church of diversity and community enrichment. And so without saying any more, I'll just thank Jack for being here and for being willing to start us with prayer.
Thank you, Ted. Let us pray together. Open our minds and our hearts, O God, to the wonder of your grace. Allow us to be transformed by the miracle of your love. And then in your goodness, enable us to share those gifts with others. Through Christ our Lord. Amen. In my presentation this morning, I've made a couple of assumptions, and I'd like to begin there. The first assumption is one that I owe to my teacher, Carl Michelson. Michelson had a wonderful way of presenting ideas that were worth hearing. And one of those was this. In his humorous style, Michelson was often fond of saying, you know, I have a real issue with Jesus. And people would kind of snicker and laugh and so forth. And then he would lay in the substance. He says, Jesus has called us to be the church. And he didn't give us a manual. Now, people could challenge that in terms of pointing to the scripture or to church history or whatever. But as I think about Michelson's challenge, I tend to think he's right. And I think he's right in the context that have you ever thought how you define the church? Is the church the building? Is the church the body of Christ? Is the church a point of view? Is the church a refuge? What is the nature of the church? And when you begin to wrestle and try to come to grips with a working, realistic definition of what the church can or should be, you raise the second assumption. And the second assumption is this. The definition of the church in every era of history is very much influenced and shaped by the environment, the culture, the society in which that church is trying to understand itself. Take those two assumptions and let us apply them to the Black church as it emerged into the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Eric Lincoln, who is an African-American scholar, has suggested that undoubtedly following the Emancipation Proclamation, the Black community entered into a time of transition that was horrendous, to use his words. One of the tremendous changes that began to occur was that we see a dynamic migration of African-Americans who had been slaves, now freed, moving into urban centers. At first, they moved primarily into southern cities because they were geographically close. And as that 19th century came to a conclusion, and as Reconstruction was being redefined, we have the emergence of something called Jim Crow, separate but equal. More critically, violence and lynchings. Even more devastating, in a sense, an inability for a person to find a job, a home, a place in which they could live. And so, while those dynamics were operative in primarily the southern states of our country, in the northern states, something else was occurring. It was called the First World War. During that era, the predominance of industrial mechanization and production occurred in the northern tier of states. And during the beginning of and continuance of the First World War, those industrial centers in the north needed more and more laborers. That was caused by two things. Number one, it was caused by the need to produce more bullets, more guns, more tanks, more whatevers. The second thing that affected the need for labor was that a lot of Europeans, primarily first-generation Europeans, who had migrated to this country, began to return back to their native countries in Europe as a kind of statement of support and awareness. And so the migration that initially was directed into southern cities now began to find its way north into places like Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, even Pittsburgh. And for our purposes in our discussions, what we have to say is that by 1930, two-thirds of all of the African-Americans living in this country were living in large urban centers. And because they were living in large urban centers, many of those people were stripped away from the roots out of which they had come. The family structure that had been very important in the slave quarter and in the first few years of Reconstruction was suddenly decimated. Why? Because the male, whether it be a husband, a father, whatever, had to come north to get a job and thus was separated from the family. Where families were able to migrate north as a unit, once they got to the north, if they found it necessary for both parents or spouses to work outside the home, and thus we have a tremendous development of juvenile delinquency. We begin to see a lot of poor widowed moms. We begin to see a lot of single people trying to make it through the day. And what we can call that is a lack of cohesion that had existed for the African-American community, ironically, during the slave era. Once again, Eric Lincoln has reminded us that this terrible sense of the absence of cohesion in the Black community was really experienced and expressed most dramatically in the nature of the Black church. Thus my assumptions. One, we always have to define what the church is. Number two, the context in which we do that oftentimes shapes the meaning of the church. And so we take a look at what was occurring in the life of the Black church during this period of time. To say it generally, because the church, the Black church, was changing in its understanding of itself, it was no longer able to truly meet the needs of its constituents. It was becoming much more secularized. It was becoming much more a church associated with status and also the need to protect one's positions. Suddenly, the Black church did not look at all like those slave churches that we talked about last week that were initially invisible, but even more beyond that, it began to not even look like the church that occurred as the visible, as the invisible became visible, and men like Richard Allen actually structured denominations. The church changed. It changed, for example, in terms of its message. For centuries, the Black community, gathering at the, as the church, heard sermons about it's going to be better in the next life. There was an addressment that somehow there was hope out there in the world yet to come. Secondly, in those slave quarter churches, the Bible and Bible stories, things that one could remember and more critically relate to, were often utilized. Three, the sense of identity in those churches was very important. People were known by their name. They were known as individuals. There was a warmth and a humanity that centered around the life of the church for African Americans. As the church changed in the first decades of the 20th century, suddenly that had all changed. And it had changed because of an interesting dynamic. Lincoln reminds us, Eric Lincoln, that is, Lincoln reminds us that for some African Americans migrating north, there was some degree of success and development. For example, they were able to find jobs that paid well. More importantly, they were able to find jobs which allowed for them to have professional developments. Three, they were also finding work that was more suited toward a kind of personal development. And number four, they began to develop a kind of class system. And the Black church, the institution that sat on the corner, the institution that was found in places like Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, Baltimore, suddenly began to cater to the needs of this emerging, more professional, more educated class of African Americans. Perhaps one of the most significant prototypes of that change has to do with Adam Clayton Powell and the Abyssinian Baptist Church that was located in the Harlem section of the Bronx. That church, if you closed your eyes, had become very white. That church had excellent music that reflected the European traditions. Two, the preaching tended to be much more out of the secular world, addressing questions of politics, economics, and justice. Three, the average size of a church, the average size of a Black church during this era was somewhere around 800 to 1,000 people. And therefore, the sense of proximity each to the other, the sense of community, the sense of knowing each other's names and each other's families suddenly was no longer operative. The Black church became white. And if you know anything about Adam Clayton Powell, you know, for example, he was one of the very first Black legislators. He was a man who did not speak in the Black dialect. He was a man who culturally was very, very white. And the Black church that he served suddenly took on that persona. So try to hold in your mind this notion of a church now defining itself based upon a select group of people who had somehow made it in the white culture and were feeling acceptance, affirmation, and even a sense of personal development. Now, what you have to also keep in mind is that the percentage of people that fall into that category was not terribly significant. There were lots of African Americans who could not identify with the secularization and the assimilation issues of the Black church. What was it that they were looking for? Well, there is a play currently on the theater circuit in Philadelphia. It has to do with garbage men. And of course, they are Black garbage men. And it talks about their frustration. It talks about how it was that as they collected the garbage in white neighborhoods, oftentimes they threw things into the truck that they later took out of the truck and used in their own home. The play makes the point that to be Black in America during the middle of the 20th century was difficult, especially for the lower middle class African American. And so what were they looking for in terms of a church? They were looking for a place of warmth. They were looking for a place of acceptance. They were looking for a place that affirmed their personhood. On a personal note, I've really come to understand that. Because as we have begun the process of trying to find a church, one of the things that I find that has really been difficult for both Barbara and me is that many of the churches that we have visited make no attempt to know who you are. You sign the book, you indicate an address and a phone number and an email, and guess what happens? Nothing. And that is the experience that the great majority of lower middle class Blacks in America were experiencing in terms of their church. Number two, Sarah, you might appreciate this. They were interested in going to church where they could hear their music. Their music was the song, the shout songs that had come out of the slave quarter. Their music was the Negro spiritual. Their music had to do with that heartfelt, rhythmic, as over and against the more European staid concepts of hymnody and music. Three, they were also looking, for a preacher who was biblically based, a preacher who was emotional in his delivery. And as Eric Lincoln describes, they were looking for a preacher who every now and then began to sing the nature of the sermon. And so you can see that the church on the corner, the Abyssinian Baptist Church replicated all across the North, now somewhat culturized in terms of the white culture, simply was unable to meet those kinds of concepts. They were, the average African-American at this time faced a kind of theological desert. And so you have to ask yourself the question, what happened? Well, what happened is we begin to see how it was that these people began to define and understand and find the church they were looking for. And the first expression of that church that we see is something that I call the storefront church. A storefront church is pretty much exactly what those words imply. It was usually a vacated store, a cleaning store, a hardware store, a drugstore, didn't matter. It was a storefront that had been evacuated. Why? Because it had failed. More often than not, storefront churches were found in the less desirable neighborhoods of large urban centers. These storefront churches began to develop. Eric Lincoln, to whom I'm so indebted in terms of this context, reminds us that during the period of the 30s, 40s, and 50s in America, the highest percentage of African-American congregations that were begun were storefront churches. Why was that? Pretty simple. Pretty simple indeed. The storefront churches specialized, not by design, just by nature, by definition. They specialized in being a warm, emotional, accepting, named community. When people walked through the door of the storefront church, they were not handed a visitor's guide and a pencil to fill it out. They were called by name. Hi, John. Hi, Mary. How are the kids? The sense of social cohesiveness managed to find its way into and through the storefront church. Number two, the worship in these churches tended to be very much in the tradition of the slave quarter churches. The music was right out of the heart of slavery. It was the soul music. It was the shout music. It was the slave music that later became known as the Negro spiritual, the kinds of things that Mahalia Jackson, as one of America's most significant gospel singers, managed to capture and develop. There was a sense of recognition as the song was either played or sung. Three, there was a high degree of energy, And what I mean by energy is this: the preacher was really into what he was, and they were mostly men. They were really into what they were saying. It wasn't some sort of a classical kind of potted plant approach where in a very calm, organized, structural way, the message was shared. Not at all. It came out of the heart, and it was necessary for African Americans to have that kind of an experience. Worship was very free and easy. There was a lot of hand clapping. Every now and then, the preacher would actually break into song. There was dancing. There was a sense of identity in the worship experience. They also spoke a lot about heaven. They talked about what death was like, because you got to remember something here. That upper middle class that we talked about that tended to gravitate toward the Abyssinian model, They were a distinct minority. They were the minority that were able to live in safe neighborhoods. They were the minority that were able to get good jobs. They were even people who were able to get medical care. For the great majority of African Americans, that was not the case. And therefore, death was reality. And of course, as racial violence escalated, the concept of violence against African Americans likewise increased. And lastly, but not least, the storefront church actually spoke out against what it perceived to be the injustices, and here's the word they used, the sins of the time. They were called jackleg preachers, primarily because they had no certificate. They had no background. Many of them were illiterate. Many of them shared Bible stories based upon the oral tradition. But these jackleg preachers, at least by their perception, told the truth. And what was that truth? Got a problem. Just hold on. Barb's going to go get the phone. You see, I'm just in such demand, I can hardly find any space where I can't be free. There we go. All right. The jackleg preachers identified, for example, that the use of alcohol was a destructive force in the African-American community. They also identified the fact that family structure, when ignored, was a serious problem. They talked about the violence inflicted upon Blacks. And yes, even in those storefront churches, they talked about, they didn't use the word, of course, but they talked about the evils of racism. The Black storefront church was not only a place where African Americans could identify with the heritage of worship out of which they had come, it was a place that sustained them. It is estimated that during this period of time, the greatest percentage of new Black congregations meeting in America, the highest percentage of those were in storefront situations. That's the first response that the African community, African American community, had to a changing church. It created, identified, and then embodied its own. And it was an attempt to somehow reach back into where they had been. Because you remember last week, where they had been in terms of the Black church that emerged as the invisible and the visible churches merged, they were places of education. They were places of socialization. They were places of political understanding and orientation. And that is what emerged in these storefront kinds of settings. Now, there is a second approach, a second methodology that was created. And I've struggled to find a word, and the best word I can come up with is the word cult. Now, I realize that word is terribly, terribly freighted with endless numbers of connotations, but this is what I mean by a cult. A cult, in my judgment, is something that, number one, is centered around a very charismatic kind of individual. It's very unusual to find a cult that does not have at its core a very strong personality who becomes almost the embodiment of what the cult is about. And so the second concept of a cult, in my mind, is not something that seeks to return to yesterday, but more so, it is something that is trying to address not only today, but tomorrow. Inherent in cults is usually a kind of protest, a kind of need to reform something, change something, move forward in terms of something. So as I use the word cult in this section of the presentation. Try to keep those concepts in mind. A very strong, charismatic kind of individual. And number two, a program, a style, a message that did not seek to return to yesterday, but was interested in redefining and reshaping, reshaping tomorrow. Now, when we talk about the Black community in terms of cults, we very much have to talk about two kinds of cults because they were very different. The first cult that I'd like to kind of talk about a little bit is what I call the holiness or sanctification cult. They were people who were looking for a pure understanding of what the church was. They were people who were trying to somehow redefine the Christian tradition. And how did they go about doing that? Number one, they created environments of worship that were filled with joy, happiness, peace, all of those good feelings that most of us wish to experience. The sanctification holiness cult that emerged in the African American community during this period of time did not return to the slave quarter. No, that's not the point. They found within themselves an enormous sense of joy. Number two, they also began to address the quality and the nature of life. And they emphasized the value of life that was lived in what I'm going to call a state of holiness. You will remember that I suggested that the Black community at this point in time was subject to all kinds of social kinds of deprivation. And that in turn had had an enormous negative impact upon families and upon individuals. These holiness cults talked about the holy nature of living. They talked about living a life that was free from sin. They were also people who took very strong stands on things like alcohol, card playing, dancing, anything that suggested any kind of carnal experience. The African American cult, holiness and sanctification in character. They were not about returning to the slave quarter. No. They were interested in realizing what it was that would make today and tomorrow a better experience for individuals. I'd like to take a moment and introduce you to a person who was one of those dynamic, charismatic leaders of the sanctification holiness cult movement amid the Black community. Are you ready? Her, yeah, that's important to remember. Her name was Bishop Ida Robinson. Who was Ida Robinson? Well, she had been born in the state of Florida. She grew up living in the state of Georgia. And most of her childhood and early adulthood had been shaped and intimidated by Jim Crow, by violence, by lynchings. She was also a person by gender who had witnessed how it was that African-American women did not have much to say in the life of the community or then again the church. She became converted to Christianity at the age of 18. And what we mean by converted was she began to sense a kind of empowerment to do something about the conditions in which African Americans found themselves, and more specifically, in which African American women found themselves. And so she and her husband left the state of Georgia and they came to Philadelphia. Why? They were part of the migration we talked about earlier. They were looking for a job. They were trying to find a way toward a significant future. Upon arrival in that community, based upon her conversion, she began to attend a small holiness congregation. It was pastored by a man whose name was Benjamin Smith. By the time Ida Robinson got to that congregation, Benjamin Smith was growing older. He was not as strong as he once had been. And as a result, she began to fill in for him whenever he was unable to preach. Her preaching was animated, charismatic, dynamic. She demanded your attention. She related to you in a very direct kind of way. Number two, she was also a preacher who every now and then broke into song, thus addressing the emotional musical needs of the congregation. And guess what happened? You're right. Because of her style, because of her personality, she was a very keen person, very smart, very verbal. She was also a student of the Bible. She was not a jackleg preacher who was illiterate. She had read the book and she understood the book. And as a result of that, she based her understanding primarily about women on the book, the congregation grew in size. It became a dynamic kind of place. But then Ida Robinson had a problem. She encountered the sexist leadership in that little church that was tired of hearing the gospel proclaimed by a woman. And so the complications forced the necessity for her to leave, which she did along with her husband. And they joined a movement in America that was known as the United Holy Church of America. It was one of the very first national organizations that today we would call Pentecostalism. She was consecrated to ministry in that church. And she was finally ordained. Think about that. She was ordained as a valid gospel preacher that organization. The congregation that she went to serve grew, understandably. And as it grew, she began to have what she called visions and dreams. And she became more and more aware that what she had been called to do was to, as she calls it, loose the women. That means free women in the context of the church and subsequently the society. She actually said that God wanted her to be the vehicle by and through which women would be confirmed and ordained to full clergy rights. That didn't go over so well, even with the United Church that she belonged to. And as a result of that, she resigned and she requested the state of Pennsylvania to issue a charter to a new church. The new church was called the Mount Sinai Holy Church of America, the Mount Sinai Holy Church of America. That church had 9 official persons who ran the show. 6 of those 9 were women. She was a dynamic preacher who understood how to create a dynamic worship experience. And she became the spokesperson for the very first kinds of Pentecostal cults that occur in the Black community. These are some of the characteristics of that community. Number one, before a person was admitted into membership, they had to go through a strenuous time of testing and fasting to demonstrate that indeed they were a Christian. Number two, singing and clapping of hands was a part of the worship experience. Number three, the testimonies of individuals mattered in that community. And of course, finally, the sermon delivered by Bishop Ida Robinson became the focus of the worship setting. It should also be noted that this movement developed and matured. At the time of her death, there were some 84 churches that stood in the tradition that she had begun. They also had begun to ordain pastors. And of the 160 that were ordained, guess what? 122 of them were women. They organized an accredited school that allowed kids to learn how to read. They did work, missionary work in Cuba and even in South Jersey. And more critically, this church, the Mount Sinai Holy Church of America, became a place where Black people, African Americans, could come together in the context of worship and be empowered. That's the first kind of cult that we see in America in terms of Black religion. It is about sanctifying the holiness of life and living according to those disciplines. Now, I've got to keep track of time here. Oh my gosh. The second kind of cult that we see is much more secular. It tends to be much more of a political, economic kind of organization. And the second kind of cult that we're looking at here is best described as a cult of nationalism. And what we mean by that is this: the cult that developed around this kind of concept was much more interested in creating Black power, creating a Black nation, than it was in terms of providing emotional worship, Negro spirituals, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the people who was most influential in that development was a man by the name of Noble Timothy Drew. Noble Timothy Drew. Grew up in New Jersey. He also made several trips to Egypt and the Arabian peninsulas. And while he was there, he became fascinated with the Muslim traditions. When he returned to the States, he began small groups that met in people's houses. And in those small groups meeting in people's houses, the Quran was used as a vehicle for instruction, the manual. Number two, Allah, the Muslim concept of God, was now perceived as the only true God. And he became obsessed, Drew became obsessed with the idea that Blacks would only find salvation as they discovered and practiced their national origin. And what did that mean? He meant by that that Blacks should no longer be called by the names that white men had given them, but rather they should change their name as an indication of their changed lives. He also was a person who believed that Blacks should live separately from the white community. That is to say, become a community within a community. He began to develop not churches, but they were called temples. The first temple was in Newark, New Jersey. A second was developed in Pittsburgh, then ultimately in Detroit, even into some southern cities. And ultimately, Timothy Drew, now known as Noble Drew Ali, A-L-I, established a temple in the city of Chicago where it thrived. What was the nature of this national, more secular, more politically, economically directed cult? Number one, discipline, personal and collective discipline were highly prized. For example, in those churches, in those temples, services began on time and they ended on time. They also talked about dietary restrictions. If you belong to one of those cults, you didn't eat eggs or meat. You certainly didn't use any intoxicating beverages. And listen to this, you were not allowed by law to attend any European style games, baseball, football, whatever. The movement that was begun by this guy, Drew, really set the stage for what I think is the kind of the climax of the development of the cult that was interested in secular identity, known as the Black Muslim community. It doesn't go unnoticed that Wally Fard, F-A-R-D, who is credited with being the founder of the Black Muslim movement in America, had his first temple in the city of Chicago on the South Side, in the area where Drew had been very successful. And of course, as this cult concept emerged and morphed, it became what we today know as the Black Muslim movement. It is a movement that says that indeed white people are the devil. It is a movement which says that Christianity is not the religion of the African American, but rather the Muslim tradition is the religion of the African American. It is a concept that says blacks must be economically and socially independent of the white community. And they go so far as to talk about the concept of Armageddon, in which the evil people, the whites, will be defeated by the good people, the blacks, and the emergence of a nation will occur. Clearly striking and frightening kinds of issues. So the Black Church in America today, as we speak, lives with all of those strains. We still have the Black storefront churches out there. Today we call them Pentecostal groups. We still have certainly the cult that's out there. They're everywhere. Some of the ones that were existing, for example, the Black Panthers have gone out of business. But the movement of Black Muslim tradition in America is still very, very present and clear. The church today, the Black church in America today, is really struggling with what it's going to be and how it's going to be defined. And next week, when we come together, we're going to talk a little bit about James Caan, who was a theologian and who tried desperately to provide a theological as over and against political or economic notion of what the Black church is called to be. Case in point, I end where I began. What is the church? Well, the church is whatever we define it to be. How does that happen? It happens because of sociological, cultural, political, and economic pressures that come to bear, that force change and a new direction. And if there's anything at all I would want to leave with you today is this. Today in America, when we talk about the Black church, we are talking about a terribly diverse setting, ranging all the way from the model of Adam Clayton Powell, right up through and including the models of Black Muslims. And here's the takeoff on that. I think you can not only say that about the Black church in America, you might also be able to say that in terms of the white church in America. We are as diverse, we are as shaped by culture, as is this history that I have tried to describe for you this morning. Black church in America, white church in America, we all define them based upon our culture, our sense of politics, and to some degree, where it is that we fit in the context of attending a congregation. I have 10:30 and I think I've overgone my time and I apologize, but maybe we do have a moment or two for a couple of either observations, comments, or questions.
Great. You've done great, Jack. We do have time for questions. So if anybody's online and wants to unmute their microphone, I see we have one question here. So I'll bring the mic to Dan Paul.
Before the recorded part of this started, you were commenting that there was something in what you were going to discuss that would be controversial. Yeah. What was that? Any more than earlier weeks?
I'll take that as a compliment. What I was referring to was the very specific, detailed discussion of how it is that in the case of our being together, the Black Church, but in a much larger sense, how it is that churches have very, very different, constantly changing identities of who they are, what they're about, and what they proclaim. I have found, and it could be just my experience, but I have found that sometimes that can become very controversial as a church goes through that kind of an experience. Thus, you can have First, Second, Third, and Fourth Baptist, the Presbyterian churches. You can have splinter groups that come off like the Free Methodist Church, et cetera, et cetera. The controversy that I think is that I would refer to is how it is that the church is identified with and defined by the culture in which it lives. And that sometimes is not a good idea. And when churches do not comply with the changing modes of a culture, oftentimes you see that church struggling. That's what I meant by controversial.
John, did you have a question?
Just a thought and observation. It seems like every one of these versions of the church is in some way countercultural. The church is a response to a culture that, the people within the culture who are in the church have to define themselves by. So it seems like I always come back to the thought of Jesus as the most countercultural person and the model for the church. So I guess every preacher, every teacher, everyone that wants to speak the truth is countercultural in a way. And so I that's just a thought that comes into my mind. You've blown my mind this morning, and this is the result of what happens when a mind is blown. We come up with a question is, what is the truth? And
right.
The truth, what our culture tells us, and it's always, no, that's not the case.
Yeah, the nature of how any church lives and works in a culture, I think, is a question which must always be on the mind of leadership, because cultures change. And the word truth for me, John, is increasingly a loaded term. I'm more and more thinking about truth in the context of the framers' understanding of the union. And that is that we are constantly moving toward a more perfect union. We should be, in the church, I think, moving toward a more perfect understanding of the truth. Quite obviously, the word perfect is a Methodist term that grows up out of John Wesley's understanding of human perfection in this life. Did he mean that we would necessarily achieve it? No. What was more important to Wesley was that we'd be constantly moving toward a more perfect truth, which also implies that we don't have it at the moment. And I think that for me, the church needs to be constantly open to changing, not only changing cultures and times, but the very nature of truth itself. And I think that's the mandate of Jesus, to realize that we don't have the truth and we're moving toward it as best we can. And that's going to mean change. That's going to mean difference. It's also going to mean some scary experiments from time to time.
Jack, I'm going to make a technical observation, and that is, I think you have a separate camera from your computer. And when you answer the questions, you tend to answer it to the computer. And so we see the back of your head.
I'm sorry.
No, no worries.
That's the best shot of me you can get.
Bobby?
Yeah, I'm going to come alongside John Hayes's comment about Jesus being countercultural. And I agree that that's certainly true. I want to go back to this notion of the Black Muslim the idea of the temple and the idea of using the name Allah for God. But where was Jesus in that? I'm sure that was he central there as he is now, or at least we hope. And one other thing I would, while I'm asking this question, Jesus said, you'll know them by their fruits. And so this, the temple cult, I don't know quite what to call that, but were there fruits? Did they do service? Did they help in their community? Did they look after the least of these? Just curious.
Let me try to, yeah. First of all, in terms of the role of Jesus, in the cults that emerged around the secular, political, and ultimately Muslim traditions, quite clearly, Jesus was often considered to be a prophet. Now, if you think about that, that doesn't match up with the Christian concept of Jesus as Lord and Savior. However, Jesus as a prophet, Nabai in the Hebrew, which means able to read the signs of the times, suggests that there is a role in the church and in all of these organizations for a more prophetic approach. Jesus, however, the cult that was formed by Noble Drew, certainly its successors in terms of the Black Muslim movement as described by Elijah Poole and now by Farrakhan, they say that Christianity cannot be the religion of the Black man. They say that the only true religion of the Black man is the Muslim tradition. So that there was a clear demarcation moving away in many of these cults from a Christian kind of perspective. Your second question is, have they had an impact? The answer is yes. If you look into, for example, the history of the Black Muslim movement in America in the 20th century, what you're going to see is that the Muslim tradition has done a lot in terms of social conditions for African Americans. It's also, in fact, Elijah Poole Muhammad, who was the leader of the Black Muslim nation, talks about the fact that one of the great problems for African Americans has been an absence of a good sense of self-identity. And the Muslim tradition is all about affirming and sustaining a positive sense of identity on the part of Black people. The notion of discipline in your life, and it's no accident that men like Malcolm X were attracted to that concept and wanted to develop even more strenuously. So yes, you have to say that organizations like the Black Muslim movement, and even to some degree storefronts, but they're harder to track because they don't have the national organization as such. But these movements had a profound positive impact. Did they have a negative impact? Of course they did. But then I would remind you that so has the Christian church. We haven't always been on the best side of history. But the Muslim tradition, no question about it, has had a very positive impact upon primarily the Black community. And it's interesting statistically to note that the highest level of recruitment by Black Muslims is among people who are imprisoned or people who are desperately poor. That is where they emerge. And if you know, you know this already, it's rare that you see a Muslim gathering where people are not properly dressed, shirts, ties, a sense of standing up for themselves and having a positive sense of identity. And you know, one of the great Muslims of our time has been Muhammad Ali, the boxer, who is controversial, of course, but who nevertheless represents how it was that as a man, he had a sense of a very strong sense of identity and value. I don't know if that gets to your question or not. And if not, please, respond. I'd be interested to know.
So I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording and say thank you very much. But if there are other questions after we stop, you're certainly welcome and would love to hear them.